This is part two of a two-part recording of Justice Murray Sinclair, who spoke at the University of Winnipeg on Monday, September 21st. In this second segment, Justice Sinclair speaks about the work of the Indian Residential School's Truth and Reconciliation Commission and what they hope to accomplish in their five-year term. You can download and listen to both segments on our website at www.blackmask.ca.
Our commission is has been given a very significant mandate and a significant amount of money. But I'm not here to argue that it's inadequate or that it's too large. All I'm here to tell you is that what we are called upon to do and how we are called upon to do it requires some very careful planning and consideration, because it's an ambitious project that we've been given. And if you think about it, the aspects of truth and reconciliation themselves could be an independent inquiry in and of themselves, each one. We could spend all of our time just looking at the truth, just recording the stories of the survivors and the families of survivors and the stories of those who worked in the schools and the stories of those who wrote policies about the schools, the stories of those who created the schools. And we could spend all of our time just researching how these schools were, and we could spend 5 years and spend all of our money doing just that, and we would still not complete the story. At the end of the day, there would still be work to be done. Or we could leave that aside and we can spend all of our time working with communities just looking at reconciliation. How can we help people to heal? How can we get survivors to talk to the government and get the government and the survivors to reconcile with each other? How can we get the leadership at both levels to work on reconciliation, to work out a deal so that eventually we'll stop having this turmoil and conflict in our relationship? How can we do that? How can we get the students who abused each other to reconcile so that they can live together in the same community, sometimes in the same household, and sometimes always in the same family? How can we do that? How can we help them? How can we help the individual reconcile within himself the fact that he went to the school and then he came home and he abused others in his community and his family, and the sense of guilt that is felt about that? How can we get that person to ask for forgiveness from the ones that he or she abused in his lifetime? Because they have to have a relationship. Those who work in the palliative care industry with whom we have spoken have told us that it is almost inevitable with Aboriginal survivors that as they approach their end of life, they want someone to come and help them to work through this history that they have. They need help to reconcile themselves with what they have done and to reconcile with those they have hurt. And there is no one there to help them. There is no one there who knows how to do that. It has not been recognized yet how important that is for the individual. And we need to do that. We need to turn the professions around to recognize the importance of that. Because if our people are going to be healed, they will need help to do that. It's going to come from within. But they will need help in order to do that. And we have to change the way professionals consider the problem. We have to change the way that society considers the problem. And it may be at the end of the day that our leadership at government level and our leadership at the Aboriginal level will never be able to reconcile this past. They may get stuck up on constitutional debates. They may get stuck on legislative changes. They may spend the rest of their lives talking about whether the Indian Act needs to be changed, altered, removed, repealed, replaced. They may spend all of their time talking about funding for housing, funding for their programs, and never come to agreement. And maybe that will always be the case. But what's important is at the community level and within the families, we can do something. That debate will always go on. It may be that there are some things, as some elders have said, there are some things that can never be forgiven. That may be. But I think there is still a lot that we can talk about. People need to be able to find peace within themselves and find peace between each other that we need to help them find. And sometimes they can't do it alone. They can't even do it together. They need help in order to do that. And we need to figure out how to do that, particularly when it comes to using traditional means of reconciliation. Because to this point in time, the approach has largely been a Western medical model, and we know that that's not working. One of the things we ask people to keep in mind about our commission is that it's a unique kind of commission because it was created by means of a court settlement. It was not one that was created only by government, as many commissions are in the world. Our research has shown that there are well over 60 Truth and Reconciliation Commissions that have been established in various countries throughout the world with various mandates. Not all of them government created, but all of them with some kind of government support. And those commissions all have a unique history to their particular circumstances. But ours is unique because we were created by virtue of a court order approving a settlement between parties to a class action litigation. And those of you who are not lawyers don't need to be too concerned about all of the formalities of that. But the reality is that because it's approved by a court, there is an ongoing obligation on the part of the court to assist the commission in its work. So the court has an ongoing supervisory role that we need to understand and respect. And as I have said to government officials, each time they come to us with a new set of rules they want us to accept, I say, well, let me go and talk to the judges and see if they agree with that. And often that's where the conversation ends. The commission is funded through a settlement amount of $60 million that's been approved. This was approved by the parties. Both the government and the churches contributed to this fund. And the churches have had some input into the drafting of the mandate, as well as the government. But I would say probably largely the mandate document itself was approved by, or was drafted by government lawyers. Because the government has tended to take the view that this is their commission, that they think that this is something that they have a lot of control over. And we constantly remind them, this is survivor money. This is money that would have been paid directly to the survivors if the survivors had not agreed to put this amount of money from the settlement of the class actions aside to be put into a fund for the commission. If the survivors had not agreed to that, then they would have been entitled to receive this money and it would be paid directly to them. So it's their money. They wanted it to be used in this way, and we're treating it that way. And we think that's the appropriate approach. And this is not a government fund. This is not a government-funded program. This is not a government program. Purpose of the commission is not to look into the questions of guilt or innocence. We're not there to determine that somebody actually did or did not do something. The issue is, as one of the elders said, even if you can't determine who's telling the truth, even if somebody says A and the other person says B, you can't decide which one is the accurate thing, he says, you still have a problem that you have to fix. And that's the problem, then, that you have to fix. You don't have to determine whether A or B is right. What you have to determine now is those two people are there in front of you. What can you do to help them to come together? And that's the approach that we're going to take to the mandate that we've been given. We have an obligation to look at the historical account, to create a proper historical record, a full record of the residential school legacy here, and to ensure that those people who participated in it and were damaged have an opportunity to heal and are provided with means by which they can heal. And at the same time, we are there to encourage reconciliation between the parties. We have asked government officials and Aboriginal leadership this early on in our mandate. We are now only 2 months into our mandate. We have asked them now to begin to think about what are the gestures of reconciliation that you are prepared to make in order for the leadership to show the way for the people, because we think it has to come from the leadership. We have to provide an opportunity for people to tell their stories about this part of Canadian history that a lot of people just don't know about. While we've heard some of the stories and there's been some publicity about the commission and some publicity about the schools, the actual creation of the schools and how they came about and what they were there to do has not been well publicized. In Manitoba, there have been 15 residential schools, and these are only the schools that have been approved under the settlement agreement. There are other schools that are subject of ongoing litigation as to whether or not individuals who attended those schools are entitled to some compensation. But those of you who've been to a residential school, or those of you who've had relatives in a residential school, will recognize the ones from this particular list. The residential school, former residential school that was in Portage la Prairie, has been taken over by the Long Plains First Nation, which have now taken steps to establish it as the Indian Residential School Museum of Canada. I think that that's an amazing endeavor, and we should see what we can do to support that kind of initiative. We are not able to issue subpoenas. We can't compel people to testify. We can't compel people to appear before us. There is a process available by which individuals who are the subject of claims can be made to appear and be told that if they don't appear, then there may be an award given for something that they're alleged to have done, and that's the individual assessment process. Those of you who filed claims know what I'm talking about. Those of you who know individuals who filed claims will also know what I'm talking about. But basically, that's the compensation process that you go through if you claim that you have suffered a grave personal injury as a result of being in a residential school. We are required to host events across the country at the community level as well as at the national level in order to raise awareness about the residential school experience and the impact, and to pay for those things out of our proceedings. Our goal is to ensure that we acknowledge the validity of the residential school experience. And I tell people it's not our job to tell somebody they're not telling the truth when they come and tell us a story, or that they are telling us the truth. Our job is to say, it's obvious that that story has had an impact upon you. Now, what can we do about that? What is it that you would like us to do? What is it that needs to be done in order to help you get through this, to help you get past that? And that's, I think, a significant question that survivors have not been called upon to think about to this point in time and need to begin to do that. Because, as that elder says, we cannot continue to walk into our future backwards. And that's an important message. We are required to provide a holistic, culturally appropriate, and safe setting for former students, for their families, and opportunities as they come forward, and communities as they come forward to the Commission. We are required to witness, support, promote, and facilitate truth and reconciliation events at the national level as well. And we're required to hold national events to educate the public about the residential school system. We are undertaking a massive public education process to ensure that people understand what the schools were about, where they were located, how they were constructed, who ran them, who went there, if we can get that information. We're experiencing some difficulties about the issue of school lists and who went to the schools because there is ongoing litigation that the Government of Canada insists requires them to prevent disclosure of that information, and so we're addressing that.
You're listening to Black Mask, the Frequency of Resistance on CKUW 95.9 FM. This is part two of a two-part recording of Justice Murray Sinclair, who spoke at the University of Winnipeg on Monday, September 21st. You can download and listen to both segments on our website, www.blackmask.ca.
We are required to create as complete a historical record as possible about the residential school system and its legacy, and to preserve that record and make it accessible for future study and use. We have to submit to the parties a report within 2 years of our setting out that complete history, including recommendations to the government. And that report has to set out the purpose, how the schools were operated, and how they were supervised. And we have to look seriously or significantly at the effect of the schools, the consequences of their existence, including systemic harms, not just individual harms, not just the kind of things, the stories that we've heard, but also the whole issue of what systemic harm individuals suffered. Intergenerational consequences is there. We're talking about the children of survivors and the grandchildren of survivors. We have agreed as commissioners, for example, to sponsor forums in every major location in Canada to bring survivors together with children of survivors, if we can. Maybe children of survivors alone, to talk about their view of the implication of the residential schools upon their lives. We are also required to support commemoration events, and under the settlement agreement, a $20 million fund has been established to allow for there to be a monuments and commemoration events held. We don't control that fund. The money still remains in the hands of government. But we are entitled to recommend to the government how that fund should be spent. And so we are going to be preparing recommendations to the government about that. And we are also called upon to prepare a comprehensive historical record on all of the policies and how the schools were operated. One of the interesting mandate issues that we've been given, it was actually a small comment in the mandate document, but I think it's maybe our most significant undertaking, will be to establish a national research center looking into the issue of Indian residential schools and to ensure that it is permanently established somewhere in Canada. We have decided that if we are going to have a national research center of that magnitude, it should be independent from government, it should be soundly financed and established, and it should be in an academic institution so that it has freedom and the ability to look carefully into all of the things that relate to residential schools. So we have indicated that we're going to approach the academic community in Canada and ask for an indication of interest as to whether anybody would be prepared to house a national research center. We're required to host 7 national events in the course of the 2 years. We've asked the parties to consider whether we can host those events over the 5-year term rather than 2 years, because it's such a significant amount of work to put on a national event. National event is intended to be an event which engages the public of Canada at large in a discussion about residential schools. So we consider them to be major undertakings in which will there not just be a discussion about residential school at a conference-like setting, but in which there will be displays by artists about their work on the residential school issue. We expect to engage musicians to undertake pieces of music that will inspire people to get into a discussion about the impact of residential schools, and to have the artistic community as well do artwork as well as plays, poetry, and writing. So those of you that are inclined in that way, get your pencils sharp, get your music ready, because we're going to be calling upon you to give us some indication of your interest. And we are also required to support events that at the community level. So we have a fund that we are going to be using to help communities. And by communities, I'm not just talking about geographical communities. We are also interested, for example, in engaging the gay and lesbian community to see if they're interested at their level, for them to have a discussion about residential school legacy. And so far as they're concerned, we're interested in engaging the gender-based communities, the men and the women, to see if we can have forums separately, whether that would be advantageous. We certainly are going to sponsor a youth forum, and we're probably going to sponsor a forum with professional people as well, because we think there may be issues unique to professional people about issues related to their education, the limitations placed upon their ability to function in their own traditional community as educated people, and how we can help them to overcome that. And I just speak to that because I know from experience that that's an issue that we all struggle with. And those of you who graduate from university and go on to become doctors, engineers, lawyers, I can tell you that you will be experiencing that on an ongoing basis, how to reconcile your profession and with your desire to have contact with your culture. And finally, we are required to undertake an event to support a commemoration initiative towards the end of our mandate, to ensure that at the end of the day we leave in place a monument of some kind. It doesn't necessarily have to be a physical monument, although that might be the way it goes, but some kind of a commemoration initiative which places forever in the minds of society the fact that this event occurred and that it affected all these people and that it should never occur again. So that's the mandate of the things that we've been called upon to do. As you can see, it's a long and difficult road that we've been given, but we've only given a short time to do it. 5 years is not a very long time in our world. You know, you think about how long it took for them to get us to this point in time. Been 150 years of residential schools and certainly policies based on residential school thinking that we've been living under, and now we've got 5 years to try to fix it. We're not going to fix it in 5 years, I'll tell you that right now. What we are going to do, though, is we are going to engage you in a discussion as members of the public about this issue. We are going to get you thinking about the issue of reconciliation, and we are going to show you how reconciliation can be done, how it can occur. And we are going to talk about your role in contributing to that reconciliation. That's ambitious, I understand that. But I think at the same time, it's important for us to think in those ambitious terms. Thank you very much.